We'll talk about maybe in the next sometime in the next 3 or 4 hours, there'll be a clash going on right now, right? Time wise, I can't quite tell. 3 o'clock Iranian time is when more and more people were expected to show up and protest in the streets. We won't be able to catch it live like we did in Egypt, but we could see, by many people's estimations, 2011 will be the last year for this particular theocracy in Iran. Will there be a new government with new freedoms for the people? It seems like the new generation coming up is demanding it. And they're sick of all the contradictions and the bloodshed, too, of Sharia law in Iran. That's just part of the story of Sasha Mostafi. She's the author of Cemetery of Dreams. We'll talk more next about the famous failed U.S. rescue of the 52 American hostages held in the American embassy after the fall of the Shah. I want to give a quick shout out, if I can, to people in Denver. I forgot to mention this earlier, but it's kind of fun. There's a new pet store in Denver called Chuck and Don's Pet Food Outlet, and they have my book. I know it sounds silly, but it's a kid's book. It's a fun book about our dog that we had for so long, named Dizzy. Dizzy the Mutt with a Propeller Butt, and it's now available in Denver at the Chuck and Don's Pet Food Outlet. I think there's only one of them. I think it's in, is it Cherry Hill, the name of the neighborhood? Right, it's in Cherry Hill. Cherry Hill Village. Go take a look for Chuck and Don's Pet Food Outlet. They have a copy of my book. If you want to see it, you can buy it in the flesh right there. Go. I'm just tickled to be in any bookstore anywhere. I'll take it. Certainly a pet. Nothing wrong with being in a pet food store. But for Cemetery of Dreams is available. You can link up to Sasha Mostafi online at coasttocoastam.com. Click on to the link for her book and take it from there. Very interesting. And we're just getting into the meat of it next on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Punnett. All right, I just have to correct that because I've been corrected. That place where you can buy my children's book is in Cherry Creek, not Cherry Hill. So I was wrong. So thank you so much. I'm enjoying this conversation quite a bit, Sasha Mostafi and her book, Cemetery of Dreams. And we were talking about both your fascination with and mine with the failed American hostage rescue attempt in April of 1980. And you said that as you began to research into this from where you were in Iran, you started to see different pieces to the puzzle to it, that it wasn't just about this, the fine sand of the Habub sandstorm that got into the gears and affected the way that these helicopters got mired in the sand of this secret site when they were coming in low under the radar in Iran, coming in to establish a base from which they were going to launch a rescue attempt of the 52 American hostages. You're saying there are some other pieces to this and involved the active involvement of Iranian military officials. Can you be more specific about that?
First of all, congratulations on your book.
Oh, thanks. It's been around for a while. It's a great little book, though.
It's good. I'm sure it is. Basically the idea was that what these official, military commanders were saying, that the whole effort was to not only help with the hostage rescue mission, but also to overthrow the Islamic regime, which had just been newly established. So the military, you know, the CIA agent, half American, half Iranian CIA agent, had been able to recruit hundreds of military officers who were willing to work together to overthrow the regime. And that there were several coup attempts that had happened at the beginning of the revolution, with none of which were successful. But apparently this was another one that they claimed had been in the works.
And so what were, I mean, we, I know that the, it was called Operation Eagle Claw. The overall view of it was that, but there was, the idea was they were going to come in with 6 to 8 helicopters, establish a landing base, And then once they had that, then they would inch closer through trucks and through CIA operatives, get closer to the American embassy where they were all being held, and they were going to extract them from there and then take them back out again to this helicopter base and take off.
Exactly.
And there's a lot of Americans that have wondered whether we got the complete story on that, because it seemed like there would have to be so many other things to make an operation like that successful, yet we really don't know that much about what they were going to do and what went wrong.
Right, yeah. I think in general, most of that is correct. It's just what they were saying was that the reason it failed is different. Now, I can't give the reason for that because that gives the ending of the book away.
Oh, no. You can't do that. You got to. That's a novel. I encourage people to read the novel, but we can't withhold that as the centerpiece of this conversation and say we're not going to tell it, because they'll buy the novel or they'll buy it for somebody else. But we got to know, right, what you know. And I think that's really important.
All right. Well, the idea was that they were basically saying that one of the things that the American military or CIA didn't take into consideration, which seems rather odd, was the proximity of USSR. Basically, USSR had just taken over Afghanistan at the time. And so and the U.S. was very worried about the fact that Iran might be next. That was one of the things that was on their mind, but once based on some of the things that went wrong within the mission at the beginning, such as taking off a little bit early for the main plane that took off at the beginning, basically they feel that USSR might have seen that, and that
really, it
was the USSR's intervention that ended the mission completely.
Really? So how did the Russians intervene?
Basically by staging a missile in the by sending a missile into the, or dropping a missile into the staging area.
Wow.
Yeah. So you just gave the ending of my book away.
Well, technically you did, but that's okay, because that, we're here to talk about that, but that's really interesting. And I've never heard that before, that this would have been what ended the mission, not fine send. And I could see where, to avoid an international conflict, you know, or not to further amp up the embarrassment of a failed mission, that the U.S., if that were true, that the U.S. would be willing to admit to that.
Right. Yeah. It was. It was. It's basically, the idea was that the Russians didn't want the U.S. to talk about it, and there was an argument. There was a discussion between Carter and Brezhnev at the time to not bring that up. So the decision was made not to bring it up.
And this would be information from Iranian sources or from Russian sources?
This information is from Iranian sources. At least, you know, I have no way to verify this personally, obviously.
Right.
But this is from Iranian sources who claim to have been there when it happened. They were on the ground there at Desert One when it happened.
Wow. Now, you've heard the story of how they were going to get the Americans out of the embassy. Did you hear how they were actually going to do that?
That wasn't, you know, very clear to me. That part of it has always been a little bit fuzzy, but I think the idea was, the first thing that they had thought of was to kind of have people, military parachute in there, do a parachute, and just, which sounded crazy, so they decided not to do that. But then they were going to go in via trucks, as you said, and try and get the hostages out.
Well, there's a piece to that, which I'll tell you from something that happened to me, and I can't verify the truth of this, but I can verify the truth that what I'm about to tell you is is actually happened. Is that the claim was that they had a gas. They had a new gas, which they were going to put into the system, the building system, so that it was being circulated throughout all of the ducts of the American embassy. We had the plans for that. Obviously, we had the blueprints for it. Mm-hmm. So they knew where to put it. and that this gas, this new experimental gas, was odorless, colorless. It was instantaneous. It was tasteless. It would go in and it would immediately incapacitate everybody to the point where they were violently heaving, and where they would start to their intestines would essentially just start to empty out. Their bowels would empty out. They would have no control over their bodily systems for about an hour or two. And this is what they said at the time. They had had a special gas that they were going to do that was going to incapacitate everybody in the building. And while everybody was incapacitated, they would just simply pluck out the Americans, as sick and gross as they were going to be. They would take them and they would put them in the trucks and they'd get them to the helicopters.
Interesting.
Now, I will tell you that I happened to be at a college campus that was in between three military bases, and several weeks before this failed U.S. attempt, we had an all-campus attack of this type of violent and immediate sickness. And at first, it seemed like food poisoning, right? It seemed like, you know, like can happen on a college campus or some sort of bug that went around.
Right.
But what was really interesting about it is I was on this campus, and I just happened to live in an apartment just off of the campus. So I wasn't part of the eating plan. I didn't eat at the campus. And I didn't go through the campus to get my mail. But what happened was anybody who did, anybody who went through that commons area were the ones who got sick. And whether they ate or not, if they just passed through the commons, that was the only common denominator they could find, is that anybody who passed through the commons was ill. Not every person ate the same food. Not everybody even ate that day. But anybody who went to go get their mail or just even to walk through the commons was instantaneously ill. What was so interesting about it was while the entire campus was throwing up violently, I mean, I remember walking down the sidewalk between classes and seeing people, about a maybe a half dozen people, on their knees throwing up in the grass. And what was so interesting about that was within hours of this quote-unquote food poisoning outbreak, doctors from the nearby naval base and the nearby army base were walking around in lab coats and clipboards. And they had been supposedly called in by local health officials to help determine what had happened with this food poisoning. But it was so suspicious because they came in so fast. I mean, there weren't any other doctors except all these Army and Navy guys walking around. And they were asking questions like, where had you been and how fast was it between when you first felt the symptoms and when you were incapacitated?
Wow.
And then a few weeks later, there was this launch of this, what we heard was going to be this gas that they were going to use in the embassy.
Wow, that's interesting. So you think they were experimenting? Is that the idea?
It's the only thing. To this day, it remains a mystery. They never figured out what the cause was it or how else. But I can't help but feel that somehow you just don't see military doctors show up out of nowhere. Like
right.
That walking around a campus. Like, that was the weirdest part about it.
Right.
And they were, they're all very benign and, you know, we're here to help. And then later on, it was like, maybe. But that would explain everything. So that's my suspicious conspiratorial mind at work. But
right.
that's what I come up with for that. But, you know, and so were there any repercussions that you know of in Iran for those people that were helping the Americans? Were there public trials or anything for people that were that had been assisting the CIA or the Black Ops military operation?
Well, not for this specific coup, but then what happened was a few months later, it was in June, another one was attempted, and that was a huge one. And my suspicion is that it would have been the same people who would have been involved in that as well. And they all got arrested, unfortunately, and the majority of them got executed.
How about that?
Yeah.
So maybe, yeah, the same people involved with it twice when they tried it again.
Yeah, they tried it again.
And that would make sense, that these are people who wanted, at least if not a military regime, to go back to some other form of government other than the Iranian revolution. From our perspective here, it seemed like, you know, all of Iran was upside down crazy about the Ayatollah Khomeini. Mm-hmm. What would you say was his real, what was the level of support? 50%, 60%, 80%?
You know, it's hard to say. They say that when people went out to vote at the beginning of the revolution for Islamic Republic, 99.9% voted for Khomeini. Now, the voting, as we've seen, isn't very fair. So it's kind of hard to make, you know, it's hard to know if it was real or not and how many people voted. I know for a fact that my family didn't. So I don't really know, but I think he had a huge number of supporters right after the revolution.
Well, and so could your family have voted and not had any? Would they? Can you vote secretly? Would the government have not been tracking who was not voting? For the president, for
no,
the Ayatollah?
No, they don't track you. They don't track you. Actually, Iranians normally don't vote because they don't think their votes count. So a majority of them, this last 2009 was unusual. A lot of people went out. But normally they don't because they don't think it's fair. The voting is fair, so they just don't vote.
Did Mahmoud Ahmadinejad win fair and square in Iran?
The feeling is that he didn't. And the reason for that is that a lot of the green guys, you know, the green movement, the supporters of Mousavi and Karoubi, who were reformers, didn't get to even vote. They wouldn't either let them in or they closed the booths down early. And they counted the votes way too early, so they knew even before all the votes were in that Mahmoud Ahmadinejad had won. So everything screamed of fraud, and that's why people got so angry. And there were a lot of supporters of Mousavi out there, so people really didn't feel that there was a chance that Mahmoud Ahmadinejad would have won.
He said a lot of things when he gets interviewed. Right. I mean, he's always one of the things he said is that there are no gay people in Iran.
Right.
What's it like to be gay in Iran? And how does that work?
It's pretty horrible to be gay in Iran. I was actually blogging about that the other day, and I was looking up some videos about that. And they just don't, you know, obviously they say they don't exist. And if they catch them together, they have been executed. I mean, this is the way the Islamic regime deals with everything, it seems. It's very difficult for the gays in Iran. And in the society in general has a lot of, you know, the culture in itself has a lot of, you know, sexual taboos and social taboos. So that's going to be a hard thing anyway to come out for gays. But on top of it, the government makes their lives very difficult. So they meet in secret, you know, and keep it very, very quiet.
Well, just like there are ways around premarital sex by doing the short-term marriages, are there ways that people get around those Sharia laws, the other sex laws in Sharia that we can talk about?
As far as gays?
Yeah, either being gay, are there ways that they circumvent that? Or, I mean, can two men live together without, as long as they don't ever say that they're gay, can they live together, or is that even immediately suspicious?
Yeah, if they live together and they keep it quiet, you know, that's fine. But if anybody can guess that they're gay, and, you know, especially the authorities figure out that they're gay, it's going to be a problem.
Yeah, but that's the thing. If you're just living with another guy, right there, it would seem like you're opening up for somebody to go to the government and go, they're gay, and then you're stuck whether you are or you aren't.
Right.
So I was trying to figure out. Well, we're talking about Sharia law. We're also talking about the fall of Iran under the Shah and the rise of the revolution of Ayatollah Khomeini, and what it was like to live under the circumstances with a woman who did, Sasha Mostafi, who lives now here in the United States. She has a novel. You can find out more about that by going to coasttocoastam.com. And I've just gotten a word about that Russian story. I'll get back to that coming up next on Coast to Coast. Well, you heard Sasha Mostafi on a few minutes ago talking about her novel, and at the end of it, she includes what she had done in her research, discovering that there had been a missile fired by the Soviet Union at the American landing base, the base of operations for Operation Eagle Claw. A past guest that I shall not name by his request here on Coast to Coast, but who has written a couple of books in the field of intelligence with some expertise in the Middle East, just sent me a quick email, and I'll share it with you about that story coming up next on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Punnett. So Sasha Mostafi, the author of Cemetery of Dreams, you can find out more about it at coasttocoastam.com. And you were talking about this this little known but discussed from the Iranian perspective aspect of the failed U.S. Rescue attempt on the 52 American hostages held in Tehran at the American embassy there, that the Soviets played a hand in that by firing a missile right at the landing base that had been set up in the desert as a base of operations to rescue the hostages. And I just thought I'd tell you that there's this guy that we've had on before. He'll be on again, I'm sure, when he has another book coming out. But he contacted me under the promise that I won't mention who it is. And he said that he's heard that same rumor.
Oh, wow.
He said, never been confirmed. He said he's never talked to anybody who was actually there for the operations that night. But he had heard that, not at the time, because he wouldn't have been old enough to be in the military at the time. But he said he heard that later on when he asked what happened. And there's apparently a couple of those types of stories where either we sabotaged something from the Soviets and we kept it quiet, and they helped to sabotage something we were doing and we kept it quiet. Each for our own reasons. So I thought I'd at least tell you that much.
That's interesting. It's great
Isn't
to
it?
Know.
So, but again, it could all just be a good story. You know, it can all be, right. but it makes, you know, that's what great stories are for in a novel. Now, let me ask you about from what you heard, by the way, about that story, about the attempt to rescue the Americans having ended with this firing of this missile from the Soviets at the operational base for Operation Eagle Claw. What did you hear that the missile was responsible for any of the deaths of any of the Americans?
Yes, because it hit. I believe it was one of the airplanes there. It hit one of them, which was packed with people.
One of the helicopters.
And, yeah, one of the helicopters, and also what happened, it killed. Based on this story, killed one of the Iranians who were also part of this. So it was essentially the idea is that the American government claimed 8 people died, but they actually died because of this missile that was fired. Mm. And they never mentioned the 9th body, which was found, which was an Iranian person. And what's interesting is, though, that in Iran, they found 9 bodies. They didn't find 8. That's what the official story said.
Hmm. Well, there's another. We were talking sort of about the official version of Sharia law and what people actually live under. And I was surprised. I think it was last year when the story came out about that very popular Iranian personality. Would it be an overstatement to say she was the Oprah Winfrey of Iran, or that she had a lot of pull anyway, a lot of popular support, and that she was supposedly in a porno tape that was being circulated around Iran. You know, the woman I'm talking about?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
And that there was some fear that she was going to be executed.
Uh-huh.
But that she said that it was all faked. She said that wasn't her, that in this DVD that was going around, this was all being done, orchestrated by an ex-fiance that was trying to ruin her career by taking some videotaped images of her face and editing them into this, you know, into the sex tape, but that wasn't really her.
Right.
And in the end, nothing bad happened to her. I mean, there was some, you know, fear for a while that she'd be arrested and we'd never hear from her again, but apparently she's okay.
No, I think if we're talking about the same person, I think she had to escape. So now she lives in Europe somewhere.
Oh, does she?
Yeah, she's not in Iran. And it wasn't a porn tape. It was apparently she was just having sex with her boyfriend, and they had taped it, you know, just to have fun.
A home porn tape.
Yeah, so it was just for them. You know?
Right. It was a private tape.
A private tape, but it was on his computer, and they had broken up, but it was on his computer. And then what had happened, or at least the story is, I don't really know. Who knows? You know what was true or not? But apparently, when the computer broke down, he took it in for service, and he had thought. I don't know if he had thought that he had erased the file or what had happened, but the guy who was fixing the computer had found it, and then he had put it online.
Right.
And so it went off like that. So that's kind of the story I heard. But the truth is, it doesn't matter whether she was in that tape or not. You know, people, you know, it's your life, it's your privacy, you can do whatever you want. It was just that it became quickly apparently very hard for her, both from culturally, because people, you know, again, going back to those taboos, you know, treating her badly, looking at her funny, and then the government at the same time, you know, coming after her. So before, you know, anything bad could happen, she thankfully got out. And she was saying that it wasn't her. I don't think it matters. I mean, I don't care.
Well, it's fine, but it was important that she said it wasn't me. I'm willing to take her word for it.
Right.
But I thought what the upshot of that story was that the Iranian parliament passed some sort of law saying if anybody is caught with that material, that they'll get the death penalty. Again, going back to what you were saying about how these laws come in as just all this bloodshed and all these different reasons to hang people. And that there actually is. Even as they're in every Muslim country, even though it's totally against the law, there is a huge, porn business going on, even though publicly the countries would, you know, present themselves as being porn free.
Yeah, I mean, no, there is definitely a lot of corruption. There's a lot of pornography. There's a lot of prostitution. It's just, you know, under the guise of all these Islamic laws, which makes it worse. It makes it hard for religious people because, you know, it makes it moderately religious people because here is, you know, there's so much corruption and disgusting stuff going on. And then it's hard for the government because, you know, I mean, not hard for the government, but it's just it allows the government to do all these things or crimes in the name of God, essentially.
Do you think that this government's going to survive the rest of this year?
I hope not. You know, I think the situation has gotten really bad in Iran, but the problem with this government is that it's extremely violent. The difference in Egypt was that, you know, Mubarak, you know, was no angel, but he wasn't this bad. And Mubarak was more like the Shah. And the Shah didn't refuse to essentially, I mean, the Shah refused to fire on his people, on the people at the end. He just left. But these people are not going to give up, especially because they're not going to be welcomed in the international community if they fall. Nobody's going to really take them. So they're going to, I'm very worried it's going to be a bloodbath, but I'm hoping that the military will turn. There's cracks within the Revolutionary Guard. That's good news. And so hopefully, as the military and the Revolutionary Guards start turning a little bit, or at least don't play the game, maybe the protesters can win.
What would be the upshot of them having some sort of nuclear weapon? If they were having a launchable nuclear weapon, what do you think as a former, you know, resident of Iran and somebody who watches what's going on there? What do you think the government would actually do if it had a fireable nuclear weapon?
Right. First of all, it's hard to know if they do or not from this distance.
Right.
I don't think anybody knows, really.
But if they did.
But if they did, you know, I don't know. I have a hard time knowing what sort of, because they're a little bit unpredictable, so you can't really tell. But I think, you know, the way the Iranian government is and the way I've always seen them is that they do tend to bluff a lot, you know, and they tend to talk big but won't necessarily act that way. But that doesn't mean if it's an act of desperation, you know, who knows? I really don't know.
Would there be support for a nuclear missile attack on Israel?
No, Absolutely not. I don't, you know, the Iranian people, despite all these news, this news that gets out, Iranian people are very peaceful people. They really, and that's, I think, part of the reason these people have survived for 30 years in the country. Iranian people don't want another war. I mean, we've lived through the Iran-Iraq war. Most of this generation, I mean, I've been through the Iran-Iraq war. We're tired of bloodshed. I don't think people would ever support that. So no, but I think that what is dangerous if Israel attacks Iran or the U.S. decide, I don't think U.S. would, but if we decide to attack Iran, I think what would happen is the Iranian people would suddenly turn around, because at the end of the day, they'd rather have a government of their own, no matter how awful it is, than have to have an external government inside.
What do you think the U.S. should do if Iran had a fireable nuclear weapon? What do you think we ought to do?
I think at this point, what is being done is probably pretty right on spot. I think what we need to do is support the movement in Iran. I think that the Iranian people should overthrow the government, and I think it's going to happen. It's a time thing. I don't know how long it's going to take. But I think keep pushing the human rights angle, keep making embarrassing the Iranian government. The sanctions, you know, are hard on the Iranian people, but if they're carefully, at some level it does help. They do help, unfortunately. And just continue this way and then open up the communication. Just make sure that Iranian people have access to the outside world. They can talk, they can communicate, so that they can plan, because there's nothing Iranian people want to overthrow the government. At least the majority do, I think, at this point.
So that would be good. But if they don't do it on a timetable that stops the government from developing a fireable nuclear weapon,
right.
I do fear for what might happen, because the second they have it, we just know from the rhetoric of Ahmadinejad, that he said, you know, he talks about it like it would be nothing. It would be his obligation to wipe out Israel.
Right. Yeah.
And I just think that's one of those things that you can't err on the side of optimism,
right,
when it comes to a character like him, especially if by launching something like that, he thought he'd be reestablishing his support in the Muslim world,
right,
and that he would become a hero.
Yeah, I don't think he'd become a hero by doing that. I think the only time that the people would take the side of the government is if an attack happened, you know, if somebody attacked Iran.
Sure.
But yeah, I get your point. And it's a difficult one. I mean, it's hard to know. They are insane. You don't know how they're going to react.
No.
But part of the thing is also, I think technologically, I'm not quite convinced that they're there. I think that, you know, when you look at some of the stuff they come up with, like they came out with this flying boat about six months ago that they unveiled, and it was this huge thing, but they just looked funny. So,
yeah.
You know, that's why it's just hard to know how advanced it really is.
Again, we're talking with Sasha Mostafi. Her book is Cemetery of Dreams. It's a novel, but it takes place during the important historical period of the failed U.S. military rescue of the American hostages in the American embassy, as opposed to the six Americans who got out with Canadian passports?
Uh-huh.
Right? Who got out of the Canadian embassy? I always thought that was really clever.
That was
pretty lucky that they were able to do that. So in the last minutes we have here before we take some phone calls for you coming up, what's the hardest thing about being a woman under Sharia law?
I think the hardest part is just not having your rights. You know, I remember I left Iran when I was 16. I left because I had no freedom, and I didn't know what it was called. I just knew that I couldn't do what I wanted to do. I couldn't dress or be who I wanted to be, and I always had this fear that once I got out of college, I can't, you know, if I marry somebody, you know, I might not be able to divorce them. It's not going to be so easy for me to get a job. And so these were all these restrictions. And what it comes down to, I think, is everyday life. You know, it becomes, you know, we take a lot of daily things here for granted. But the reality is, you know, even today, every morning I wake up and I say thank you because I have all these freedoms that I just didn't have over there. And I hope that the Iranian people will get to have that soon.
In Iran, do they do any of the female circumcisions that we hear about in other Muslim countries?
No, they don't. That's
good.
Yeah.
Good. Not a problem.
That's one.
There.
That's yeah. positive.
That's good. Hey, let's highlight that where we can, right? And because that just always sounded so awful. And it was just obviously it's just a terrible mutilation. But the is there any other upside to being a woman in Iran? Do you was there anything else that's sort of unique maybe to the Iranian Sharia law that other countries, other Muslim countries are harsher on, that they're not as harsh on in Iran?
I think, you know, the fact that women can drive. Saudi Arabia, you know, women don't drive around.
Nope.
Iranian women in general, despite the laws within the country, are very free in a way in the society, in the culture. So they tend to be within families and within the culture and society, they're pretty much in equal footing with the man. And you don't always see that in the other parts of Middle East. So I think I wouldn't talk about the Sharia law as being better, but I would say culturally, Iranian women tend to be pretty sophisticated.
Are there the slavery issues in Iran that there are in other Muslim countries like Saudi Arabia, where people are brought in essentially as slaves, although technically I guess they're indentured servants, but where they have zero rights and they might come in from the Philippines or they come in from other countries and they have no family, no way. And once they get there, they're kind of trapped. Does that happen in Iran as well?
Not that I know of, or not that it's known that much. There are, of course, you know, they prosecute religious minorities such as the Baha'i, and they don't allow them to go to school, etc. And the Afghanis aren't always treated very well. They're treated pretty poorly. There is a sex trade that unfortunately goes on now with the Islamic regime. We had never heard of that before, but it's mostly because girls want to get out of Iran. And so somebody tells them, oh, you know, I can get you out. And unfortunately, it results in bad things.
Getting out means they are exported to another country where they're a sex slave.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Ugh, that's so awful.
Yeah.
Well, I'm glad you're doing what you can for that. By the way, you know, you mentioned the Baha'i, people who are Baha'i are frequently persecuted in Iran. Mm-hmm. I grew up near the Baha'i Temple in the United States, which is just outside of Chicago.
Right.
And do you know who Rainn Wilson is, the comedian? He's on The Office.
No. Oh, okay. Yeah, yeah.
Right. He's the guy with the glasses on The Office, and
right.
He's so funny. His parents used to run the Baha'i Temple there. He was the number one tour guide for his whole time in high school. He gave tours every day at the Baha'i Temple.
and he
to this day, he is America's best known Baha'i. Is Rainn Wilson of all people.
Right.
And yeah, I think if you need to put a face on Baha'i, on the religious tradition of Baha'i, it's Rainn Wilson.
You might see that on my blog.
Yeah, but go ahead, Google that, verify it, but you'll see exactly what I'm talking about right there on your blog. He's such a funny guy. All right, so that's it then for me. I've got all my questions answered. How about you? Again, the book is Cemetery of Dreams. It's a novel, but it's a historical novel, and we forced Sasha Mustafi to reveal a lot of the details of the book. I hope that doesn't ruin sales for her, because it's very well written, and it's very interesting, especially for people who love that period of American history, trying to get the hostages out of Iran. That is the true story of what happened, as she understands it from the Iranian perspective, is in that novel. So what are your questions for her coming up next? Sasha Mustafi, talking about women, Sharia law, about life in Islam, about life in a repressive country like Iran, and or that particular hostage crisis too, next on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Ponet.